here's what actually, so let's try the intro again, because I loved all this, but I feel like we're getting ahead of ourselves. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's try to just go around the circle and in three sentences, come up with a totally personal first reaction to the book. And then say, this is the measures taken. And then launch into topic by topic discussion.
But maybe you can give a little 1921, you know, that stuff. Because that's usually what we do in an intro.
That is true. That's usually what we do in an intro. Yeah. Okay. So probably. Well, let me think about it then.
Okay.
It's 1921. I just don't want to get anything wrong. It's 1921. It's the Civil War. This is, it's a popularizing text. He's already written one. He's already written Economic Theory of the Leisure Class.
That was way before, but yeah.
I mean, what kind of context is most important?
I think just that. And I think what you said earlier was actually really good, that like, this is a popularizing textbook, but we recently talked about ABCs of Communism.
Yes.
And this is not setting out to do that same project. It's more in line with like Anti-During, which we talked about far.
Oh, okay.
Just like what kind of popularization it is, maybe. Or what it's attempting.
Yeah, okay. Welcome, listeners. For this week's episode, we decided to read a classic, bona fide classic, Nikolai Bukharin's Historical Materialism. It was written right in the midst of the Civil War. It was published in 1921. It's something of a textbook. It doesn't exactly share the same goals as its immediate cousin, The ABC of Communism, which is co-written with Preobrazhensky, but instead looks more like either Plekhanov's monist conception of history, or, well, maybe even Engels' Anti-During. We had wildly different reactions to this text around the table, and so I feel like the only fair way to introduce the discussion would be to go around and see if we can get just in three sentences or less, what our first impressions were.
I don't know how many contributions I've made to the podcast that are three sentences or less, but I don't want to say strongly dislike. I don't want to necessarily render a value judgment, but I certainly disagree with the bulk of the text, which puts me in an awkward position since it's so orthodox and traditional. We'll get into those disagreements, of course, but I would like to believe that this is a version of Marxism that we need not be beholden to.
Yeah, I also disagreed with the bulk of it. Maybe the wild differences are more 1v2 here than around the whole table. I think, you know, I'll admit that I'm not always interested in every popularization because a lot of them are just kind of retreading the same ground. But I can still try to read those very charitably in knowing that what they're undertaking is very important and difficult to do. I think what sets this one in a different realm for me than, say, ABC of Communism is that I think it's straining to match Marxism with the natural science of its day in a way that isn't a simplification, but that ends up being a distortion and, you know, making proposing certain new categories that I don't think are clarifying, that are maybe muddying, and trying to make Marxism do something that I don't think it needs to do.
So we got one thumbs up, two thumbs down, and this.
Well, what was your reaction to it?
All right, before we dive into what's actually in this book, I think that it's useful to just say a little bit of something about Bukharin himself. And why, and like what strikes us about Bukharin. And he stands out to me as someone who is unjustifiably forgotten in the tradition. On the one hand, he just plays this major role in the intellectual life of the Bolshevik Party. The Bolshevik Party at precisely that moment where it's going through its period of maximal ideological diversity. It has all this talent that hasn't had the good grace to be purged yet. And so he's someone who should be revived just for that reason. But secondarily, for someone who goes through quite the political transformation and philosophical transformation by the end, by the time he's, speaking of purges, by the time he's imprisoned, he has adopted a lot more of a humanist philosophical stance than you'd ever be able to imagine he was capable of if the only book you had read by him was this one. I think it's important that he's a political economist and that he's one of the collection of, let's call them classical Marxists or first international, you know, I'm sorry, second international / third international Marxist, classical Marxist, who take that seriously. So for that reason, he ought to be paid more attention to. And then, of course, he makes for salubrious corrective to those who have spent too much time with Adorno and Lukács.
Yeah, okay, so about that. I take Bukharin seriously for all of the reasons you just mentioned. This text in particular I'm interested in because it's in line with a lot of the texts we've looked at in the course of the podcast and just in our own lives, which are these sort of like flagship texts that are meant to explain, not just to outsiders, but to party loyalists and to good Marxists, what are the basic like foundational blocks of our worldview or our ideology. And interestingly, in this period, our political practice, right? I think one of the things that Bukharin does very well, if not successfully, but one of the things that he is admirably attempting to do, and this is sort of a, it's almost a, this gets into the sort of like Kautskyist tradition of the class struggle or what have you, which is this is a man who does not believe that in one world he lives as a loyal Bolshevik revolutionary political figure, and in the other he lives as a disinterested scientist mm-hmm. studying the course of history and the stars, but that these two things are extremely, extremely intimately linked, and that all of his political positions are grounded faithfully and correctly in the true evidence of natural science. And as a book that is attempting to justify, Bolshevik communism as grounded in our correct scientific understanding of the world, this book is very exemplary of that. And that's a project that, you know, Marxists used to do a lot and that we've lost. And so for that sense, I do find it, even if I disagree and I don't necessarily think that we should be doing that these days, there is a nice I'm weak a little bit with nostalgia for a time when such ambitions seemed to be
more prevalent. Common. Yeah. I like your taste for bread with your roses on the same dish.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of Bukharin as a figure, I have much to learn, but I think one of the things that's fascinating about him is he is so often eclipsed by and identified with other figures of his era, his contemporaries, with whom he actually did have some pretty significant deviations. He's often very much just portrayed as a kind of right-hand man or inferior of Lenin, whereas they disagreed on a whole lot. And he was extremely influential, as we see in this book. So I think just as a figure, he's very well worth studying. I completely agree with how admirable the impetus for his project is that Nathan laid out. And I think we talk a lot about, you know, the new moment of Marxism means excavating old things, things that haven't had their due influence. And I think this book is in a really unique place in that I don't think the book itself is widely read, but its arguments and the counter arguments against the book are very much still in the ether today. This is very much like kind of people do talk about Marxism as a science or Marxism not as a science. And so what it lays out is part of the discourse about Marxism, whereas this book itself, which is one of kind of a constellation of primary sources, isn't read so much.
So what's it doing? And I think it's worth...
You're very sympathetic. Tell us what it's doing.
I'm pretty sympathetic, but I want to put it on the operating table with like patience. So I don't think that I would give this book to someone just starting out in Marxism for a pretty simple reason, which is that both the natural sciences and the social sciences have developed pretty significantly since this book was written, and that has a deeper effect on a book like this, more like Plekhanov's monist conception of history, more like anti-During than it is like something I would give everyone I've known, like the ABC of communism, or even Karl Kautsky's Precy on Capital Volume 1, let alone things that are, you know, things that are more politically oriented, like Rosa Luxemburg's great works, etc. No, I wouldn't give this to the starting out Marxist. Does that mean, though, that it's free of insight? One of its greatest strengths is how concretely detailed it is. He's got all of these really useful concrete examples. For me, myself, I'm enamored, of course, by what he says about symphony orchestras, and I found that really insightful at some previous moment in my development. But it's not just symphony orchestras.
No, it's not just symphony orchestras. Okay, we should try to do a little overview of what it is that he's trying to do, and maybe where me and Matt divert from your own position on this. The Bolshevik, let's put it this way. Communist revolutionaries are in a strange sort of position vis-a-vis their own Marxism and their own so-called theoretical and scientific commitments. Mm-hmm. On one hand, they are engaged in what is, to all outside observers, a deep voluntaristic project filled with things like irrational human subjectivities run amok. They're trying to overthrow society. They have this minority vanguardist theory. You know, they're really This is human agency seems to loom large. Mm-hmm. At the same time, because of the certain historical peculiarities of in intellectual lineages, all of their political decisions in this regard must be grounded not as subjectivist utopian fantasies, which of course we would be against, but as scientific necessities. So what he's attempting to do is starting off with not his political practice, but starting off with a sort of a specific conception of cause, determination, and necessity, mm-hmm. in which then politics will find its end to that. And I think maybe that's a way to start on. We should get into where Bukharin fits into
Right. It's about, it's a philosophical text in the sense that it's about freedom and determinism, and what are the core categories that underwrite the social sciences of which Marxism is queen. Mm-hmm. And I do think that he's trying to disabuse us of some of the more, well, I mean, we have to also remember about the context, which is that he's, who is he going up against? He's going up against, in the context of a backward society, its ideological core, which is populated by mystics on the one hand, mm-hmm. and on the other, you know, these kind of science mystics. You know, those who believe that ultimately at the bed of reality is nothing but subjective illusions. The world as it is in itself has no substance. And, you know, the vital transformations in the history of human flourishing or degradation are ultimately products of their will and their ideas. And so if that's a dominant mode of understanding history and social progress, then this is acting as a corrective. I don't think that Bukharin is in a context where, like we're in, where the threat that, you know, that Marxism is so determinist as to have undercut its own foundation is, it's not that it's not present, it's just that it's not that threatening.
I think he's also in a unique situation here where he is part of a project that is trying to usher in a new form of society and running up against numerous obstacles. And part of that is that there are all of these sciences that are inhibited by their own biases, as he is quick to point out, all of these existing bourgeois sciences, bourgeois philosophies, things like this, that are meant, that their purpose is to present the capitalist world as one that is ultimately rational, as one that human history has been tending toward. And so his project is to undermine that in this very difficult time when society is in an upheaval, and to make the case that these unexamined assumptions that bourgeois science makes, inhibits it from understanding the potential for social change and for further, as he would say, rationalization of production and distribution.
The thought is, you know, there are some things about the world that we have ascribed to forces beyond ourselves. And what Marxism teaches us is that there are a certain number of, there's like a subset of those forces that that are in a process, already in a process of transforming from things that look like natural causes, like storms or pandemics, to things that are under our own planned control.
Well, I think that's a great launching off point for us to get into one of the defining and most controversial concepts that he either introduces or takes from Marx, depending who you are.
He's just a Libra.
Sure. But the concept of equilibrium, which his detractors say that he borrowed clumsily from physics in order to kind of justify it in the language of that day, and supporters might say is completely compatible with Marx's ideas about equilibrium in terms of value and price. But anyhow, his main point about equilibrium, we'll get into the kind of subsections of external and internal equilibrium because I think those are important, but is that any society is striving for what he calls equilibrium. And there are certain moments where that equilibrium is disturbed. And often, for him, that equilibrium is disturbed by some sort of technological innovation. And suddenly the way that things are produced is out of equilibrium. However, if it's possible to adapt the way that one produces to that technological innovation, then the society regains its equilibrium for a time. And that a kind of revolutionary moment of disequilibrium is one in which there are certain advances that the society cannot possibly adapt to. So it is very much technological change as the primary term in this process in that way.
I mean, it looks to me exactly like you were saying, that he's taken what is a well-known theory, a sort of correspondence theory, which is where there's a given state of the productive forces and there is a given relations of production. They're supposed to correspond to one another. When one of those things is changed by who knows what, therefore they fall out of correspondence and they start to, you know, walk with a limp and get a little herky-jerky. And so we need to modify it so that we get back into the old well-oiled machine.
That's right. And society is, in fact, become more fragile.
But instead of suggesting correspondence, which is sort of the phrase that people steal from Marx, which I also don't like, but we have this notion of disequilibrium, which makes it sound more like it's, yes, reliant on some sort of physics model that makes it sound like it's the result of a scientific process rather than the result of political struggle, obviously. I don't know if our listeners, they probably are, I would imagine. We have a lot of well-read listeners familiar with this basic debate within Marxism about the relative primacy of the productive forces vis-a-vis relations of production in terms of what helps to explain and motivate transformations of the economy and of social life. I think around this table, it's safe to say that Matt and I err on a side that puts relative primacy on relations of production, which are downstream of class struggles, and therefore the outcomes of which are highly contingent and contested, and that Bukharin certainly errs on another side, which is to say that at a given level of the productive forces will eventually will its way to victory, and therefore the outcomes of political struggles, while contested, seem to arrive with some degree of certainty, which is why I think it falls, you know, which is why they run into such difficulties when the certainties of which they were certain do not arrive on time. But we could say something about, I think listeners are familiar with that debate, but we could say something about, yeah, what Bukharin says about that and why, you know, I find it so troubling.
Absolutely. And for just in preparation for that discussion, we maybe should just make explicit a distinction between productive forces and productive relations. So productive forces doesn't not include human beings. In fact, it centrally includes human beings, their labor power, and, you know, their population, their conditions. Lots about human beings are included in that productive forces category, along with, of course, the availability of resources and techniques of production. That includes things like machines. But it's important, I think, to not confuse productive forces with, you know, how good the machine, the spinning jenny is or something like that.
I think that's important. I don't know that Bukharin makes such a fine-tuned distinction in the text, which is the problem. He doesn't just say productive forces, of which we would have to include the laborers themselves who operate the tools. At many instances, he uses the phrase just technology and social technique, and that it is the level of technique that is available that best explains how men then organize themselves around such a spinning jenny.
That's true. There's an emphasis. And part of that emphasis has to do with the nature of capitalism, which selects for a certain kind of efficiency in production against other kinds of efficiency in production, and happens to be characterized by this drive towards mechanism in large sectors of the productive economy. And so for Bukharin, who's focused on the transformation between capitalism and socialism, I think that he's liable to fall into that, into that trap.
I think for me, what makes equilibrium not entirely satisfactory as a concept, and that's not to say that what I concede is obviously replacing is always presented in the best way. I would think that the idea of contradictions is the term that that others preceding and following him have often used. And there is the potential argument that equilibrium, if not presented sufficiently dynamically, as Stefan did, debatable whether the book does, it can give the sense that there are moments during which these contradictions in society lay dormant. And, you know, the political conclusions of that are interesting. But I think that he gets into then, I mentioned earlier, internal and external equilibrium. Just going to paint over them very quickly. The idea is that external equilibrium is the equilibrium between a society and its environment. An internal equilibrium are disequilibriums within the society. And I think the reason that I find these categories not altogether durable is because, Stephanie, you brought up like pandemics and things like that earlier, and I think that point's very well taken. But it seems to me that what Bukharin means by environment here isn't that sophisticated. It seems to me that it is looking for kind of this rarefied, pure, untarnished realm in which social relations don't play the role that they do in internal equilibrium. And that's what kind of raises my hackles a little bit there.
Well, so we should say what we mean by social relations then. So we've said, you know, there are productive forces, and I've emphasized the human element in productive forces, and let's put a pin in that. Then on the other side, there's social relations, and that includes things like capitalist worker, serf lord, you know, any of those relationships, which are really about, you know, they're often enshrined in juridical categories, and can, you know, that is to say, lots of, you know, productive forces, lots of levels of productive force can take very different social relations. So Lukács, in his Critique of Bukharin, makes the point that Marx himself points out that in early manufacture, that is an early capitalist manufacture, the techniques of production aren't that different from what they are at the end of the Middle Ages. And therefore, we can see that, you know, while one selects for another, that is, one type of technique is going to select for certain kinds of social relations, and certain kinds of social relations are going to be fit to certain kinds of technique, they, you know, and over the course of history, they're never matched one-to-one. They don't, you know, they're not like that. We put a pin in this idea that productive forces don't include humans, but I just want to point out that that Bukharin is at least aware of this, even if his emphasis lies elsewhere. So when he talks about the physical destruction of elements of production, he mentions, on the one hand, the destruction of things, and then immediately the destruction of persons. When he talks about deterioration of the elements of production, he says, here belongs deterioration of machinery for lack of repair, and the physical exhaustion of workers and their intellectual exhaustion, etc. So he's at least aware that humans are down there making things.
No, I'm aware that he knows that. And again, I mean, I also don't know that it's necessary to get into competing quotations. I think a lot of times...
No, we shouldn't, actually.
We absolutely
shouldn't. Terrible way to argue.
And there's a lot of, like always, there's always a lot of caveats. You know, everyone always hedges a little bit. But ultimately, what I think, you know, I say, but I am going to read one quote.
Hell of a preface.
Okay, you know, where he's talking about the mode of production and production relations, which he describes in a very glib, dismissive way as a, in a certain sense, the style of the social economy, which is already a little bit of a, he's already waving it off a little bit. And this is a quote right here. And the uniformity of this style proves the dependence of the mode of conception on the mode of production, of the system of ideas on the system of persons, and the latter in turn being conditioned by the system of objects. And, you know, I think it is that latter emphasis on the system of objects that's so reminiscent of the very famous sort of Marx lines on commodity fetishism, which is to say the world appears to us as a relationship between objects.
I actually don't think that's what Marx says. I think that what Marx is trying to say is that value looks like a property of objects, but is actually the product, is that's an illusion. There's a, that would be a fetish to think that that somehow the commodity itself held the value in its you know, its physical constitution or something. That's fetishism. But in fact, there's social relations mediated by objects. But again, I don't think he's talking about the world. I think he's talking about value. He's not saying that the world, you know, is a product of human subjectivity, and that it would be a mistake to ascribe anything in social relations or in history or to our own cognition to objects. It's that we shouldn't ascribe value to objects.
Okay, I honestly would have to think about that for longer than on the podcast, but I don't think that's necessarily right, because I think it's not just about value as a concept or an attribute of objects. We have to remember value as a social form through which we create and adjudicate the social division of labor. And insofar as it's about the social division of labor, that is not a quality that inheres in objects.
Yeah, it's those social relations that were meant to be pointed to in Capital. Capital is ultimately, even though it looks like a book about political economy, it's actually a book about certain kinds of social relations, a specific kind.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot, I was listening to you and then I had something else to say and I've forgotten it.
I have
now.
One more thing that I think...
Yeah, keep going.
Let me monologue on this episode. Okay, so in the same way that I think it's a mistake that Bukharin seems to end a lot of his arguments with his point of emphasis being on technology and literal objects, I think one of the things that, in a way, in a perverse way, is also kind of what we're talking about, admirable about it in terms of its ambition, which is that it follows this this iron necessity all the way down. But this goes all the way down to like the individual in Bukharin's work, and in this work in particular, to a sort of theory of cognition that is extremely narrow.
Yeah, okay, what's his theory of cognition then?
His theory of cognition is basically, you know, we think we have things that we call desires and thoughts, the idea that we mistakenly call the self. But really, I mean, I'll find the line. It's essentially a mechanical notion of subjectivity in which, you know, all of our thoughts and actions are actually the result of, you know, some kind of physiological process occurring in the brain. And so in the same way that what we think of as the class's behavior or the random bourgeoisie's behavior is in fact determined by his station in life, that he is just the willing apparatchik of his material conditions, in the same way our own thoughts are in our own subjectivities and desires are in fact just the sort of outcome of the mechanical wheel turning in the brain.
So I don't think it's the mechanical wheel turning in the brain or whatever, but I think that the only alternative to a theory of cognition that doesn't hinge on something physical happening in the brain is some version of spiritualism. I don't think we get around that so easily. And so I'm uncomfortable by that mode. I don't think that Bukharin provides us enough of a theory of cognition to draw a red line between a class position. We already know how uncomfortable we feel about slotting individual human persons into class categories, but between a class position and something happening in the brain. So I'm not sure that there's a way to draw that line, despite the fact that you might feel he's overly technologically focused on the one hand, or overly mechanistic in theory of cognition on the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think you were kind of getting at that, the psychology of the class being something that we can determine very neatly, I think is one of the major problems that comes toward the end of the text. And Lukács kind of points this out. There are moments where Bukharin hews really closely to these theoretical presuppositions that he makes. And sometimes he gets off the rails there. And then other times he kind of lets them go and says something very correct. Like there's an instance with, where he's criticizing, Kuhnau, and he's saying, that this idea of raw materials as something just furnished by nature is, of course, incorrect, because to prepare something furnished by nature to the stage where it can be used as a raw material involves a great deal of labor and being able to plan.
That's right.
I think he kind of forgets that when he himself talks about the environment as this thing distinct from society. But another instance of that is back to the class psychology point. He does a beautiful he has a beautiful moment where he kind of shuts down the idea of a class is just a chart, where he says very clearly the size of one's purse cannot be what we take into consideration when we're talking about which class somebody is in. There can't be these inter-class distinctions. But he then, a few pages later, has a table of the different classes with their class properties with pluses and minuses in the chart for peasantry, lumpen, proletariat, and proletariat. And these pluses and minuses are meant to help us account for all conceivable instances of psychology or behavior. And he talks, we're very familiar with the idea of the aristocracy of labor. And he takes that in whole cloth to say, you know, before World War I, there's this reason the class was bought off. We can very easily see how this segment of the class was bought off in this way. When Second International Marxism gave way to true Marxism, the class began to behave in different ways. It just all becomes a bit so, where if you have the right data points, you can anticipate and explain any set of class behavior.
We should be really clear about the difference between the two categories here, especially between forces and relations of production, because I'm actually a lot more comfortable ascribing, let's call them psychological tendencies, to classes than I am to individuals. So I do think that there are, you know, if we're talking about classes where individuals are flying in and out of them and all partially in them and partially out of them, and that doesn't really map onto a collection of concrete individuals over any kind of span of time, we can nonetheless say something concrete about what their, you know, so, you know, what their ideas are going to be like and what their motivations politically are going to be like. And we can predict all these sorts of things for classes. But all of those classes, you know, are, those are relations of production. We're talking about, now we're talking about relations of production, not forces of production. So here it's really, it's not even the vulgar historical materialist who thinks that everything is going to be a material, not even human force of production. You're uncomfortable with even psychological states being ascribed to, that is their origin being ascribed to relations of production.
Is anything determined? Can Marxism tell us anything about anything?
Wait, you should say that in the microphone.
Can Marxism tell us anything about anything? Is it?
Yeah,
a
yeah. Okay. So see, that's why that you think we're throwing everything out with everything.
I'm out the window catching babies.
But Marxism tells us a lot about a lot of things. I think one of the things, I don't know if this is helpful or not at all. You know, there's like that one, like sort of epistemological, I don't know, parable thing where it's like there's a certain version of the world where if you could, you know, if you knew the placement of every atom in the universe, you could predict the future with like perfect clarity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. This notion of the world is just these sorts of physical forces or what have you. And Bagarin comes quite close to hewing to that kind of notion. And when you so of course that example is kind of deliberately absurd, but when you start to think in those terms that all things can be determined in such a way, you know, as Matt was saying, it's just our lack of information that, you know, is what causes us to like kind of fuck up every now and then. That can, you know, I'm interested in where this can lead you politically in the ways that it can decapitate, disarm you politically.
Can you identify a moment in history where someone has taken a book like this, even not, if not this book, but this kind of, you know, you'd call this vulgar Marxism or, you know, and have like done something bad politically with it.
Because,
and I'll point this out.
Like,
One of the major theoretical revisions that's present in this text is the idea in contradistinction to what the Second International believed, which is that there would be a kind of smooth process by which no productive forces need to be destroyed in the course of societal transformation from capitalism to socialism. One of the things Bukharin introduces, along with the Bolsheviks by necessity, is this a new law, if you like, the idea that nope, and Varga also talks about this, listeners, once you get to our Hungarian Revolution episode, about how the productive forces do go through this epic decline in that transition.
Yeah, I'll give you a different kind of example, but that I think is concrete.
Well, the point would be the Second International might have been led astray by their vulgar Marxism, thinking that the increase in the productive forces was the primary driver of history and would smoothly get us across that hump. He's saying that hump comes with exactly the opposite thing, which is destruction of the productive forces.
No, and I like those sections, actually. One of the ways, here's one way I can think about it. I think if you ascribe to a notion, and we can argue whether or not this is ultimately downstream, or you can draw a line between a sort of theory of cognition or sort of mechanical notion of human behavior and this sort of ascriptive, determinative theory of how classes behave politically, right? Okay, I'm willing to separate those two things. I think they rhyme in a way that's curious and bad, but I'm willing to suggest that they're two different types of claims. But if you do believe, like, for example, and he says, you know, pretty concretely that, you know, the life situation of the working class therefore desires one thing, and in this way we can predict how these things are. I've made this argument a bunch of times. When you see people who are become your political antagonists, who were formerly your political allies, this is the case of communism and socialism. Yeah. If you ascribe their turn away from your political vision to inherent attributes of their position in life. In other words, it's not that we were once allies, they've changed their mind, or we've changed ours, and now we are at odds. when you start to think that their political views are downstream of like where they are situated in society, you start to say that in fact they're not even potential allies on the block to build the project.
I want to get back to the point about class psychology and class behavior, because Stefan, point well taken. Of course, Marxism can explain and elucidate plenty. That's what we love about it. Plenty that can't be explained otherwise. I think what I mostly want to reject from this section of Bukharin's book is the idea that it can help us in any sort of productive way predict behavior. When we talk about, you know, the aristocracy of labor, you know, that's a very convincing argument until later on in time, it turns out to be the case that some of the best leaders of the party are people who would absolutely be slotted into the aristocracy of labor. And so when you get these charts with things with the pluses and minuses, and he says, you know, the proletariat shows hatred against capital and a negative attitude on the sacredness of private property. The lumpen proletariat shows shiftlessness, lack of discipline, hatred of the old, all of these things. Yeah, sometimes. And we really hope that the proletariat demonstrates those things. But I think there's a difference between explaining something and in explaining something, taking into account the contingencies of that moment, versus using a kind of predictive apparatus of class psychology to say how a class will behave in any given set of circumstances.
You know, the proof of that is so often when these guys come up with new sociological laws that they've derived from the principles of Marxism, what they're really trying to do is explain the last failure or explain the last surprising event. So I just brought up this new law about the destruction of the protective forces across the hump from socialism, I'm sorry, from capitalism to socialism. But that's in the rearview mirror. That's already happened. This law has already
Well, that's because if you have this scientific understanding of revolution, it's the same way, well, if you've failed, then you must have made a mistake that we can correct scientifically.
I mean,
we are just running constant experiments, and eventually we'll get the answer. But of course, you can't build a revolution in the same way you can reproduce your results in an experimental laboratory.
Take away the word science and the experimental laboratory metaphor for a moment, and in the absence of those references, don't you agree with what you've just said? That it's a series of failures, and we're learning with every failure, and that after a series of failures, there will be, you know, either a better failure or a victory?
Well, of course.
So, okay, so maybe the science reference is foreign to us because of the distance and cultural distance that we have with Bukharin, but maybe not with the impetus behind the idea that this is a learning process. So I agree that, you know, that some of it is just so,
yeah.
You know? And it certainly fetishizes its relationship to the empirical sciences, with which it thinks it is in competition, by the way. You know, like the idea that Marxism should have an answer to Mach, you know, a philosopher of science, or, I mean, if it had grown up in the United States, if Marxism had been more native to the United States earlier, there might have been some grand, you know, our Marxists might have gone to war against the American pragmatists. Mm-hmm. There might have been some great purse, you know.
If only,
you know, it's like, you know, debate over pragmatism, which I think actually shares some interesting commonalities with Machism. Mm-hmm. All the same, you know, this is a book that is so easy to set aside because all of its anxieties we don't have to share, and it is most prone to fall into
our main anxiety is that we
embarrassing claims.
Well, our main anxiety is that we adopt it. I feel like if more Marxists are anxious not to be identified with the not just intellectual style, but yeah, with this kind of argumentation, with this sequence of claims.
I think that's a problem.
You're saying
with
it's
Marxism.
A bad anxiety. Yeah,
I think one of the nice things about New Moment Marxism, in fact, is that we can have that we can readopt.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear,
theoretical
no one's reading
certainty.
This book.
Well, I know. I hope we're encouraging some readers to read the book. Yeah, yeah. But I think that theoretical certainty should be on the menu, because we've just come from a generation of Marxists whose focus was theoretical destruction, and what they ended up with was a lot more like an ethical critique of capitalism that Bukharin critiques nicely than anything I recognize as, let's say, historical determinism. And by the way, that gets a bad name. But let's also, like, deflate that idea. Determinism in what sense? Just to say that history is conceptually articulated, that it isn't some random chain of events or some spiritually created illusion, but instead something that comes in conceptual shape, and by virtue of arriving in determined conceptual shape, is able to be adopted in a formally planned way by society, by the socialists of the future.
The point is well taken that, of course, our own correction that we want to make sure not to stray from right now is away from this kind of, if we just want to use this as a pejorative, which without getting into all the things it could mean, but this kind of postmodernist left where there is no, you know, there can't be a grand narrative and no kind of, you can't really erect a theoretical apparatus in which any one thing has primacy. Of course, we don't want any of our corrections to be misconstrued to lead to that. However, I think that when we talk about a rigorous, systematic theory that renders the world intelligible, as we've said many times, I think that you can present a popularized version of it that doesn't fall into things like here when he's talking about equilibrium. He, you know, for example, makes the claim that it's the Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis, which is, you know, just another kind of not even true vulgarization of Hegel. And I just don't think that you need to lapse into that degree of simplification where it becomes wrong. There has to be an ability to take in contingency without throwing up your hands and saying, I have no idea, but to be able to explain it instead of...
One of the weirdest things about the history of Marxism is that it predicted the revolution would happen as early as they predicted it to. Because by their own lights, they should have thought that the late 19th century was pretty distant from a socialist transformation of the kind, of this kind. First of all, you know, let's just talk about the underdevelopment of huge swathes of the globe, the current underdevelopment of Africa. I mean, the best argument I've ever heard against the revolution happening in my lifetime, because I'm, you know, a follow the rate of profit guy, as every one of our listeners knows, and I really do think we're living through capitalism's end times. I don't know how, without a destructive war or some other cataclysm, we can create the conditions for profitability again. However, the best argument against me is that there are huge swathes of the globe that have yet to be developed capitalistically, or in some socialist analog that gets us there by a different path. So perhaps the thing to explain is, for all their ideological certainty and science and, you know, and the inevitability, why should they possibly have thought that 1896 was like hot ticket moment?
That is funny. I was going to say maybe something similar or a nice sentiment. One of the things that is nice about it, I do not believe that the communist revolution is the outcome of a dialectical law of natural development of human society. I don't think it's a historical necessity in the sense that its certainty is predetermined. But the people who did think that, because they thought that, they were able to insist on this other point, which is denied today, but we must maintain, which is that even if it's not any of those things, it is a viable historical possibility. And I think that is very important to maintain for these notions.
If it's merely one, a live historical possibility, then that's close to denying that the choice is between socialism and barbarism, which really wants us to get into that blackmail position, where the only, either this one progressive solution happens to come about, that live viable possibility, or everything else is not worth considering because it would be literally backward, right? So it would cause the destruction of the productive forces.
What's wrong with that position? You know.
Well, the thought is, no, I love that position. It's my position. But if you think that the revolution is only one live possibility among many others, then that gets us away from the idea that it's not only one live possibility among others, it's the only progressive possibility, the only conceivable progressive possibility.